Welcome to the Barth Calderone Culture of Leadership Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women's President's Organization, Vistage, the Young President's Organization, Tiger 21, the California Apartment Association, and many more. And now, here is your host, Paul Hitchcock.
Thank you for joining. We know people have busy schedules, so really appreciate it. My name is Paul Hitchcock, and I am a co-founder and president of Giant Jacks Media, which is a firm that helps other professionals and businesses to grow and build their practices, their businesses. I'm also the director of development and education for Barth Calderone, which is an asset protection, estate planning, and business planning firm located in Southern California near Disneyland. I think, David, we can see from our office the Matterhorn at Disneyland.
Yep.
And we have a big footprint across the country with 5,000 clients. We put on about 30 workshops a year to many incredible groups, including Vistage International, the Women President's Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many others. And really excited to have David Calderone here with me today on this episode of Wealth Protector TV, which is a channel where we deliver high-value content through the law firm at Barth Calderone. And David is one of our top attorneys, one of our top speakers across the country on all the topics I mentioned. And the content we're talking about here today is the same content that's in high demand from the groups I mentioned. And so we love giving back value. And the reason we put on this show is to give you actionable tools and strategies that can help you in some way. And so, David, thanks for jumping on. And I know we're talking all the time, but excited to have you here.
No, thanks for having me. It's good. I have to talk all day long, so it's nice to let you roll and talk for a little while before I got to start talking again.
Well, listen, I did want to mention to people before I hand it off to you, David, and we start talking about the subject at hand, which is asset protection for businesses, is anybody that shows an interest in our content, shows up for a webinar, takes the time to get on these, we offer a complimentary one-on-one strategy session with David on your planning, whether it's asset protection, estate planning, business planning. We'll get you one-on-one with David and you'll get into the weeds on your own planning. And what will come out of there is David's observations and recommendations and how you can get updated and protected. So in order to do that, I'm going to just share my screen and you want to write this down. Just take a second to show you this. Let me see here. Make it easy for you. Okay. So if you can see that there, David, can you see that text up on the screen there?
I sure can.
Okay. So what you want to do, everybody, is if you text Guard Assets to that number, that will get you access to the initial intake call for getting information on your own planning. Or if you have any questions about what we're talking about here today, this is how you sign up. So take a snapshot of that, write that down, text Guard Assets to that phone number. And I'll show that again before we're done. And with that, David, let's get into the topic here of asset protection for a business. And what we're talking about is, obviously, it's a new year. What should business owners be focused on when it comes to asset protection for the business? And we're going to touch on your 50-point checkup. So why don't you jump in?
Yeah, you know, this is the time of year when people plan, right? They get reflective and they start thinking about the year past, which for a lot of folks was just awful. We turn the page to January and hope springs eternal with a vaccine on the horizon and other things that we can start getting back to somewhat of a new normal in 2021. So, you know, you start out the year thinking about goals, right? What are my goals? What are my business goals? What are my personal goals? I want to lose weight. I want to learn how to play a musical instrument. Business-wise, I want to up profit by a certain percent. I want to grow my business, that sort of thing. So it's the perfect time of the year to sit down and really ask yourself, what am I doing from a business perspective to best protect myself from liability in the future? How do I make my business run more smoothly? And how do I anticipate and see what's down the road with the twists and turns and curves, and really kind of create a plan for reacting to those and dealing with those before you actually hit them?
Yeah. And when it comes to asset protection, can you really just define quickly what you mean by asset protection? What actually is that and what's involved in that?
Well, asset protection is not a cure-all or solve-all. But what it is, it's a barrier to protect external threats from your business. And in our case, it's a legal barrier, be it the way your entity is structured, the documents you have, the things that you do in order to prevent people that would do you harm from coming in and raiding your business of your assets, hurting your employees, and ultimately hurting yourself and your family if it depends on the revenue that you generate from your business. It's almost like creating a wall around what you have that people have to deal with, you know, if they want to scale it and get to what's inside or try to scale it.
Yeah, I've heard you talk a lot about that asset protection is such a massive issue because, you know, normally there's 30 million lawsuits filed in the U.S. every year. Yeah. 95% of the world's lawsuits happen in the United States. I've heard you talk often about that. So this is, and business owners are targets, is that right? And it's unforeseen liabilities that can really take a toll.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, as you just touched on, we live in an incredibly litigious society. And no matter how good your record keeping is, how well your policies are enforced, how efficient your systems are, if you do business, you're bound to get sued. And unfortunately, it's become a cost of doing business, just like, you know, paying your rent, paying your employees, paying vendors, things of that nature, marketing, doing business. It's just, like I said, a cost of doing business. And today, unfortunately, your risk of being sued is more closely related to your perceived ability to pay, you know, as a business owner, than your actual responsibility for any damages that you or your business have allegedly caused. And business owners are also really vulnerable if they employ people because they can be held liable for the actions of their employees if they're acting within the course and scope of your employment, which again could end up costing a fortune just to litigate issues like that, right? Determine whether or not they're on or off the clock or within the scope of their employment, things of that nature. So there's tons of external threats, tons of pressure points. And these are things sometimes a lot of business owners are just not aware of because they're busy doing what they need to do to keep the doors open, especially nowadays with coronavirus and everything else.
Yeah, because we're seeing new forms of liability around the virus. But as we get into guarding the business, can you give me a little bit of a flavor of, you know, without asset protection, anything at all, you know, with an employee incident or whatever the liability might be, what happens to a business owner when a liability comes their way and they don't have any asset protection? What are the vulnerabilities there?
Well, if you have absolutely no asset protection, then you're going to be personally liable. And I would include even like just basic insurance as part of that asset protection type of scheme. So, you know, if you have nothing, then people can come after you personally. Even your own employees can come after you and try to make you personally liable for any injuries or harm that comes their way, or for perhaps for a breach of a contract, which there's never any insurance coverage for. You know, those liabilities come directly to you as opposed to perhaps like say a corporation or a limited liability or some sort of a liability shield that you place between your business and your the outside folks and yourself.
So if somebody, for instance, has signed a personal guarantee for their business and you know, the business is gone south, you know, and the personal guarantee gets called, will a creditor actually come after the business? And, you know, I've heard you talk about that all the time and try to grab a stock in the company. What happens to the business before we get into protection? What happens in a scenario like that?
Well, if you signed a personal guarantee, most personal guarantees worth their salt don't require creditors to go after the business before they come after you personally. So what's likely to happen is if the business defaults on an obligation, say a loan with a bank, in its simplest form that you personally guaranteed, the bank is going to come after the business and they're going to come after you personally. And they're going to do it at the same time. So as far as they're concerned, they're a little bit like the mafia. You know, they don't care who they get paid by. They just want to get paid. So they want to make sure that money flows to them. So, you know, the personal guarantees open you up to immediate liability, regardless of what happens usually to the entity that you're guaranteeing the debt or the obligation for.
Okay, so it's an example of a liability, personal guarantees. We're seeing that a lot with franchise owners at the firm who, you know, have signed personal guarantees to expand and the growth hasn't panned out. Employee liability. So wherever the liability comes from, even liability at a rental property that comes to a business owner, and there's exposure there. So what should business owners be thinking about when it comes to liability and how to guard themselves, and especially that personal nature of it where their personal assets can get attacked? And what do you start getting into with solutions and strategies and so forth?
Well, the first strategy obviously would be to make sure that whenever you're going into business in any sort of form, it's best to form a limited liability company or a corporation or something that's going to actually hold the business to where, you know, basically the business and yourself are not really one entity. A business has separate checking accounts, observes separate legal formalities, things of that nature that, you know, shield your individual assets and shield you personally somewhat from liability to others or liabilities for things you do regarding the business.
What does an LLC specifically do? I mean, why is that a good tool to have for a business?
Well, an LLC is great because it's a limited liability company. It's just right built right in there in the name. So, and you know, it's best to do, if you're going to do a limited liability company, even to think about doing multi-member limited liability companies, or possibly you could even bring your family or somebody else on board as a member or an owner of that company. Because basically your liability in a limited liability company is limited to the business first and foremost, and then after that to the extent of whatever ownership interest you have in the company. They're difficult to break through. Piercing that veil is similar to piercing the corporate veil. If you're observing all of your formalities, if you're current on your filings with the Secretary of State, if the business is holding itself out as a separate entity, meaning it's entering contracts as a business, not in the name of you personally, that you have separate bank accounts, you keep the money segregated, you know, your personal money and the business expenses, then it's going to be incredibly difficult for a creditor to pierce that and get to personal liability on behalf of the business owner.
I don't think a lot of business owners, or maybe some, don't realize that their business can be a limited liability company. You know, we run into scenarios a lot of times where they're an S corporation, and I've heard you and our other experts talk about, you know, the reorganization from an S corp into an LLC called a Plan F reorganization, and they can maintain their S election for tax purposes, but they can be an LLC, and it brings some additional benefit from outside liability coming down. Is that an accurate, you know, way to describe that?
No, that is correct. I mean, you know, a corporation used to be kind of the old school way of doing things. You know, you form an S corporation or closely held corporation to protect yourself from liability, and you can still do that if for some strange or some personal reason you want to stay a corporation or form as a corporation. But anytime you're holding yourself out to do business with the public, you should create and maintain an entity of some sort to prevent you from being personally liable for the things you sell and stuff you do. But the problem with corporations is they require a lot of record keeping. You got to have minutes. You got to have a board of directors. You got to deal with shares. You don't have to deal with a lot of that stuff with a limited liability company. Plus, with a corporation, if a creditor happens to sue the corporation doesn't have enough assets to pay a judgment, They could try to go through the corporation, pierce the corporate veil, and get to you. But they could also liquidate your shares in the company if you get hit along with a corporation and it has some value. They could take your interest in the company. In a limited liability company scenario, a creditor can't do that directly. They get what's called a charging order, which means is they get a judgment against the company. They perhaps maybe get a judgment against you personally. All they can do is charge the economic interests of the LLC, meaning they can go after distributions that are made to you as an owner of the LLC, like you would get dividends as a stockholder, but they can't get ownership of the asset. They can't get ownership of the LLC, right? So it's a lot different. In a corporation, they can get ownership of the shares of stock. In an LLC, they can only get a charging order and an economic interest. They can't take actual physical ownership of the interest in the LLC in order to satisfy a judgment.
Well, that's a big deal because, you know, you have a corporation, you own stock in the corporation. It doesn't matter that it's not Disney or, you know, Procter & Gamble. And creditors, as you just said, can grab control of the stock. They'll take that all day long. And that scenario doesn't exist with a limited liability company. So interesting.
That's correct. Yeah. And there's a lot less formalities that are involved with a limited liability company than a corporation. Like I said, you don't have to have a board of directors. You don't have to have board meetings, shareholder meetings. You don't have to observe those types of formalities. And basically, you can have an operating agreement or a contract that tells everybody that's a member of the limited liability company the rules of the road, how it's going to be run, what's going to be done, how the money is going to be handled. You could have a manager who manages the company, or you can have it run by the members of the company. It's incredibly flexible, and you can do what you want with it. Plus, it has enhanced liability protections that a corporation definitely doesn't have, and much more liability protection than you have. You're just a sole proprietor hanging your shingle and doing business.
What about buy-sell agreements, David? I know you brought this up offline. You and I were chatting a bit about that, but how does that factor in? You know, we've got people that own a business here, they have business partners. What do we need to know about buy-sell agreements?
Buy-sell agreements these days are an absolute must, especially in light of the pandemic and what happened last year in 2020 and what seems to be getting worse and still happening in the early part of 2021. Buy-sell agreements are almost like prenuptial agreements for business owners, if you like. Basically, the business owners get together and they determine what's going to happen to the business if something really bad happens. If one of the partners or shareholders or members of the company dies or gets divorced or becomes disabled, or if one of them wants to sell, one of them just doesn't have the money to go on anymore and wants to get out. It provides a roadmap for how you deal with those problems. It's really kind of set it like a prenuptial agreement would do in a marriage. Buy-sell agreement in a business would basically tell you what's going to happen when you guys decide to go separate ways. This is how things are going to play out. And it's a way of negotiating an exit and limiting the legal cost later on, because let's face it, litigation involving I deal with a lot of disputes. I do a lot of litigation, and I deal with a lot of disputes between partners and former business owners. And, you know, those things can run up astronomical bills. So what a buy-sell agreement does, it limits the legal cost, legal exposure, provides the party that's leaving with an economic benefit because they can get cashed out by insurance or by a promissory note and a set agreed upon value of the business. It just really it navigates the exit at the end of the relationship, because let's face it, most relationships, especially business relationships, they're going to end at some point.
Do you build asset protection provisions into the buy-sell agreement?
Yes, we have there are non-compete agreements that are usually part of buy-sells, fiduciary duty obligations, things of that nature. There's asset protection structures that are basically integrated into those documents, and the buy-sell agreement itself is part of an asset protection a vehicle or plan of attack, because really what happens, it's meant to protect the business first and foremost. You have a business, you may have employees whose jobs depend on this stuff. You've got the business owners and their families who depend on the income. And so you want to build things in there that are going to also protect from external threats as well. Not only external threats to the business, but external threats to the business owners. Like if something happens to them, there's a bankruptcy or a liquidation involving one of the owners. You want to make sure that, one small torpedo is not going to sink the entire ship.
Is it true that if you've got a business partner, whether it's in rental property or, some other business, you own something together, you are naturally exposed to each other's liabilities? And so a personal liability to your business partner, for instance, their spouse gets in a car accident and they're dealing with some liability, or they've got an IRS tax thing going on over there, because you own something with them, that's a risk that you have when you have a business partner, right? And we want to kind of put up that wall in between that.
You certainly do. And that's 100% correct. Having a business partner is a lot like having a spouse, you guys are together a lot of times for better or for worse. And you take on a lot of the obligations or the problems that your business owner has, and you have those limitations too. So yes, it's always good to try to build, some sort of a wall between you and their problems, as well as building a wall between yourself and problems that are brought in by outsiders as well.
All right. So let's get into your kind of 50 point checkup, which is sort of the best practices for business owners going forward. What do owners need to be focused on here? What are your best practices?
Well, to go back in, I guess, to the 50 point checkup, This is the perfect time of year to do it. Beginning of a new year, coming out of hopefully the pandemic and entering into some sort of world where we can achieve some sort of herd immunity and get back going. The 50-point checkup really is a due diligence review from the business from a legal and asset protection perspective. We review business structure. What's the best way for you to do business? Should you remain a sole proprietor, which the answer is almost no, or should you be an LLC or a corporation? What should your LLC be organized, or where should your LLC be organized, right? Where should your company be organized? There's some jurisdictions that are better than others. You could possibly be organized in Wyoming or South Dakota, be authorized to do business in California, which would help you possibly take advantage of the laws of, like, say, Wyoming or South Dakota, which are incredibly debtor-friendly for people that are doing business. Is your structure well-maintained from a legal perspective? Are you observing formalities? Do you have separate bank accounts? Do you have documents that are going to govern the business should something happen to you? Like a good operating agreement for an LLC or a succession plan for the business. Buy-sell agreement, which we've already touched on a little bit, that's going to dictate what happens if something happens to the business or one of your partners. We look at employee issues, including potential liabilities to the business, such as wage and hour claims, contractual claims, harassment, wrongful termination, ADA issues, other employment claims. How are your employees classified? We look at that. Are they classified properly as either regular employees or management? What do your employee handbooks look like? Are they up to date with the current law? 2021, every time the calendar turns, you get a whole wave of new rules, regulations, and laws. Is everything up to date? What are your internal employee policies? What does your employee discipline system look like? You got to remember, you can have rules, you can have handbooks, you can have all this stuff, but if you don't enforce them and you don't have a way of meeting them out fairly and making sure people are called to account, those rules can be used against you if you end up in court or in some sort of dispute.
I've heard you talk a lot about, David, last year, wage and hour issues, and then there was the independent contractor scenario. Were those kind of top line issues that were there?
Yeah, and they still are. I mean, you know, we had the proposition that just passed that's limited to like Uber drivers and you know, the folks who do deliver food and, you know, the gig economy kind of stuff. But those are things we look at too. I mean, if you're operating a business that still utilizes a lot of independent contractors, what do your documents look like? You know, how do you preserve that independent contractor relationship so you don't get hit for really having an employee and misclassifying someone as an independent contractor when they should be an employee? That's a huge deal thanks to AB5. And although AB5, there's a lot of exceptions, including business to business exceptions, there's also a lot of pitfalls with that, especially here in California. When I mentioned, like I said, AB5, that's local to California, but I'm sure other states are looking to California to see what they do and how they're going to, you know, deal with those issues in the future themselves.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about these things, you know, running, you know, having all your ducks in a row here, this is because if a liability arises, this is going to be turned upside down. I mean, all this stuff will be looked at, and if there's holes in it, you're going to get nailed. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's true. You know, like I said, the if you end up in litigation, you're going to end up in discovery, and during discovery, they're going to want to do a very full physical of you in litigation to look for vulnerabilities, to look for weak points, and to do things that they can to buttress whatever claim or case they may have against you. You know, employees. Employees are phenomenal, but employees can also turn into a nightmare as well. So, you know, you have to treat them with respect, but also, treat them as such in terms of how you protect yourself and protect your business.
If you've got an outside liability that's looking down on your business, do those things come into play also where they're going to start looking at the business and how you're running the business if you've got an outside liability coming in?
Totally. You know,
they will.
An outside liability is they're still going to want to do all the discovery and all the due diligence they can regarding, you know, whether or not your business is actually a separate functioning entity or if it's just basically your alter ego. Especially if they know that you've got a little bit of cash, or they know the business may not have a lot of cash, but they know you do, right? So it's one of those things where, yeah, you've got to make sure that you keep the walls of your fortress strong by maintaining them and taking care of them.
So here's something I want to ask you about. This was something that we ran across at our firm, is that a landlord had rental properties, also was the founder of his own business outside of the rental property. So successful business, and I think this story is repeated a lot in places, successful business owner has rental properties are building up. At the rental property, they got nailed, and this was in San Francisco, with a mold claim. And the landlord ended up fighting the mold claim because he figured it was a bogus claim, and it was. And he lost, and it was $400,000 to the tenant plus attorney's fees, which were $1.2 million. Yeah, yeah. $1.6 million liability to that landlord, and the insurance got out of it because they said because of the way the mold developed, we're not touching it. So personal liability to the landlord. He owns a business over here. So that thing is cancerous, right? I mean, it can just impact everything because there was no LLC at the rental property. This is in Noe Valley up in San Francisco, Hamlet up there. So describe, is that what can happen? That business could be torched because of that?
Oh yeah. You know, the if there's nothing between, like if there's nothing between you and the apartment building in that case, like if the apartment building is just held by, you know, David Calderon or Paul Hitchcock, they can not only go after the apartment building, try to take that if that's something they want, but then they can go after what you own personally, which would include that business. You know, if there's no wall or there's no hurdle for them to leap over, then they can go straight after that stuff when they're doing their judgment debt or discovery and trying to uncover assets. That's one of the things as a judgment debtor, you'd have to disclose. And that's part of the The big problem is once someone gets a judgment against you, it really lifts the lid on your whole financial history. There's no real place to hide in terms of privileges or taxpayer privilege or financial privacy or things of that nature, because at that point, all they're trying to do is collect on a valid judgment. So you're in a difficult spot. So you got to let them know, not only, and if it's a savvy attorney for the creditor, what they're going to know the right questions to ask to uncover all that information. So it's going to be you're going to be under penalty of perjury, and it's going to be very difficult to try to keep from disclosing that info and keep them from liquidating it.
The other thing we see too is the stocks, bonds, and cash. Not only the stocks, you know, the cash or the stocks that are kept inside the corporation. So there's, you know, they have a big fat, you know, bank account in there with all the stuff building up, but also outside at investment firms. And we see a lot of times, and this was just a call that I got recently where someone was asking, he said, "Hey, my wife and I are starting to invest for the first time in rental properties, and they own them in their own names." That was a red flag, but also they have a big stocks, bonds, and cash account, you know, a couple million sitting there. That's a sitting duck, isn't it? I mean, if you have liability, I mean, don't creditors love taking stocks, bonds, and cash inside and outside of the business?
I'd much rather have, especially cash, right, than any other form of property, even like stocks and bonds. Those would probably be next in line, though, because, I mean, that's just easy to access. And nobody wants to necessarily, you know, take over business and have to do something of that nature. Attorneys, they want to run to the money as quickly as possible. So in those scenarios, the best thing to do, especially if you've got a significant amount of that, you know, stocks, bonds, and cash, is to create an LLC just to hold that.
You can't do that.
You certainly can put a wall around that kind of stuff. Same thing goes for like intellectual property. If your business has trademarks or copyrights or patents, a great thing to do would be to take that intellectual property, transfer ownership to a limited liability company, and then license it back to your business. You know, not only do you get, you know, the benefit of walling off brand names, trademarks, things that have actual tangible value, you know, from creditors, you can also do business in a way where you could possibly have alternate sources of income based on licensing and things of that nature to move money around in your businesses. I mean, look at like Hostess, I think it was Hostess Cupcakes were bought out of bankruptcy. Basically, all the guy did was buy the brand name. Same thing with like Pabst Blue Ribbon. I think it was the same guy, actually.
Should I be embarrassed that I can drink a Pabst and eat a at the same time? Is that a bad thing?
Right? Yeah, but think about it. It's like, you know, those names have real value. And at the end of the day, that's the only thing in those companies that add value. You know, so that's worth cold, hard cash.
And are you saying that Pabst Blue Ribbon was not a good beer? It's just,
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying a lot of people didn't buy it. Right, right now they made it into, now the guy took the brand and made it into a big trendy, you know, college student type thing. It's been like Hostess Cupcakes been revived. Right. And but it's that intellectual property, right? It's the brand name. It's the identity. It has the value, not necessarily the Twinkie or the cupcake. It's the name, right?
Right.
And you want to do what you can to protect that and shield that from other liabilities of your business.
So as we're getting up here towards the window here, I want to keep this, you know, kind of quick and dirty. These are great points. But David, what is that checklist scenario look like if somebody wants to come on board, you know, the onboarding for that? You know, is it a couple strategy sessions? You're collecting information. How does it actually work?
Yeah, basically, you know, what we would do is sign you up as a client or sign you up for the process. We provide a due diligence checklist of things that we want to look at and examine. And so what we would do in our intake is I would talk to you initially, learn about your business, learn about what you do, how you do it. Ask you for the documents and things that we need. We would review those, ask you questions along the way, perhaps that are derived from our examination of those documents, and then provide you with a strategy or a roadmap of what we think you can do, recommended actions based on what we see and what we find, and based on what you do out in the real world as a business person. It's not nothing that's dissimilar to, say, you go in and you have a huge, big physical with your doctor, your annual physical, and your doctor says, hey, I think, in response to what I see in your physical, you should do X, Y, and Z. And then really it's up to you to decide whether you want to do X, Y, and Z, whether you want to do X, whether you want to do X and Y, whatever combination that you think you're capable of doing at that point in time. But at least you have somebody, a professional, saying, hey, these are things that I think you need to do to kind of shore up shop and to take care of yourself, going forward, and do the best you can to protect yourself and protect your business.
Love it. Love it. I want to share this this screen one more time here, if I can find it. Let me see here. Here we go. Yeah, for all those who haven't seen this, for a one-on-one session with David, look at any issue, big, small, in between, text Guard Assets to this phone number, and you'll get access to an initial brief intake call with me. I'll get on the phone with you to just get your information and understand what you want to focus on so we can be real tight and organized. And then get with David for a one-on-one. But listen, David, awesome information as always. I think you and I could keep talking for hours here. I want to again thank everybody for jumping on. I'll let you have the last word, David, as we sign off here.
Yeah, now I'm a 28 and a half year lawyer. I have seen and done pretty much everything there is to do. I've negotiated hundreds of deals, transactions. I've litigated hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits, including jury trials, bench trials. I've handled appeals all the way up to the Supreme Court. I've pretty much seen it all. And I use what I've learned in the boardroom, in the courtroom, to help inform my clients as to how they can protect themselves from future liability, because I've seen a lot of it happen. So I like to pour that into prevention and to help my clients avoid those risks, because I know, what one lawsuit can do to just say a family business, for example, that's got to spend thousands of dollars defending the thing. It can rip families apart. It can cause nightmares and stress. Just even beside the money aspect, nobody likes to sit, across from a lawyer in a deposition or in a courtroom. And I want to try to help people do the best they can to avoid those scenarios and to help provide for their employees and, most importantly, provide for themselves and their families.
Okay.
And we had two. We have a couple of questions. I don't know.
Yeah, let me read these questions. We'll take these now. They're coming in. If you already had an award from a lawsuit and it was put into a trust, is it protected from personal exposure then?
Just your normal, typical family trust really provides no asset protection whatsoever. But the only asset protection it could provide is if you have a property that may be entitled or owned by a trust with a name that's different than your own. It may be a little bit more difficult for someone to find, but in the end, they're going to be able to get to it. So for post-judgment planning, things like that, I would not recommend a family trust as a vehicle for that.
Okay. Let me just see if there's a follow-up. The question here is, the cost, someone's asking about the cost for the consultation. So we've got a free, the initial call with me and David is a complimentary strategy session. So you get on with me for a few minutes, I get your information, we get you to David. There is no charge for that. And you and David can have a discussion and, it gives you a chance to really kick the tires, talk to David, explain your situation. He'll have some pointed questions for you. And then from there, we would really send you, David would, his observations and recommendations about next steps and where you go from there. So want to clarify that. And last, one of the last questions we have here is liability dealing with kids. So are you, I've got four kids. I got three kids driving cars. It's why I've got the gray hair, David.
Yeah, I got a couple myself. Yeah.
It's insane. So I know, luckily I'm with you and the firm. I know how to protect myself and my family from, I have three, kids driving cars around. What would be your answer to that? You know,
my answer to that would be if they're under the age of 18, then absolutely. You know, and if they're over the age of 18, depends on the circumstances.
Right.
If you entrusted them with a vehicle, for example, and you knew that they had an issue before climbing behind the wheel, like an issue with drink or drugs or whatever, and they hit somebody, you could be responsible for that. So there are other instances where even after they've reached the age of maturity and adulthood, where you could still be liable for something that they do wrong on the road or out in life or what have you, through negligent entrustment stuff. So I would say, you know, under the age of 18, pretty much definitely for everything. Over the age of 18, depends on the circumstances.
Yeah, very, you gotta be careful. Yeah, and
depends on the circumstances. Yeah,
depends on the circumstances. All right, David, thank you. Thanks again, everybody. David, we're gonna have you on again, and appreciate everybody's time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. No, thanks, guys. It was a pleasure. Thank you. Okay.